gift to Lieutenant Stern and Miss Retzky.
Maybe both of them can share it. Anytime I see a 25-letter word, I figure it's got to be worth explanation. Maybe you could give me a better idea of what these drugs, how they're used, what they're, where they come in into play in the illegal drug world. And what is there some kind of common name to all this?
Here.
Madam Chair, Senator, thank you. Probably haven't had an opportunity yet to see it, but there was a submitted with the bill a section-by-section analysis, which was in the Senate Journal on February 3rd, pages 302 through 309. And it's because of that exact question, well, what are these things, what do they do, where do they come from? The information was taken from the DEA research, also from research conducted at various universities throughout the country. There's an explanation of the properties of each substance, what its common name is, why it is it's supposed to be classified, who it's usually abused by. So that's a general question, I mean answer. And then if the Lieutenant has anything specifically.
Let me go back and rephrase my question and put it more in Alaskan terms. What type of frequency of use of these drugs do we find in Alaska? How many cases have you seen where these drugs have been either detected or seen and not? I mean, we're putting them underneath here, I assume, because we now want to prosecute under them, right?
Yes,
am I missing some point here?
No,
okay.
That's correct.
So my assumption is that you have seen cases in Alaska where these drugs have been observed, would have or should have been prosecuted against?
No, that would not be a correct statement. What these drugs are drugs that are made outside of the legal market generally. They are being seen throughout the lower 48. We have not worked a case here, and we have not missed a prosecution here. We generally, such as in crack, don't see those drug trends as soon as everywhere else does. My thought process on this is that we have a chance to get the law in effect so that we don't miss it if they do show up. So
the best thing to know is none of these drugs have ever shown up in Alaska?
No, none of these that are mentioned here, other than the last change for the look-alike drugs.
Because I was looking over, the section analysis that you did provide. I was just curious. I mean, I didn't know whether or not they... Does it say somewhere here that they were in Alaska? Yes, I didn't read it before, but...
Madam Chair, these are all substances that have appeared elsewhere in the country, and because of their misuse and also potential for serious side effects, including death, they have been scheduled by the DEA. And what we're attempting to do is to take advantage of the DEA's superior knowledge and research capabilities in terms of borrowing from their understanding about what should be prohibited and amend our laws to change that. This is the first time since 1982 that our laws have been changed. So our laws are, 7 years out of date at this point in some circumstances. A lot of these you may have been heard referred to as, quote, designer drugs or analogs, where you take a dangerous substance and then you change one or two molecules of it. And all of a sudden, by its chemical name, it's a new substance. And you can't prosecute it under existing law because it's a new substance. Lieutenant Stearns was telling me something this morning which I hadn't known, Madam Chair, and that is that sometimes, or I guess almost always, the analog drugs are more dangerous than the original substance that they're intended to mimic. Do I have that right?
That's correct. For instance, the synthetic heroin is 80 times more potent than the heroin that we see generally used on our streets in Alaska today. It is commonly being used in the state of California now. The methamphetamine series that is designer drugged, the molecules are changed, are about 100 times more deadly than that which is being manufactured that we are finding in Alaska today. It is that kind of public safety issue that when we do get into it, we are capable of doing it, and that's our request in getting this under the law now.
I appreciate that. I'm only having a candid discussion with you on now because we got a little time to kill, basically. We could go in front of Annie's, something like that, but I'm kind of curious about knowing a little more about it, and then if you just kind of go along with me, Appreciate it. So what you're saying is these designer tricks. See, I'm learning all the time. This, you know, they tell me I'm going to get click one school of law degree here pretty soon, but keep it going.
You need a little longer.
2 years won't get it?
A little longer.
Associates?
Oh, jeez. We are on teleconference and on records. Do you have another question?
The drugs in here, are the drugs in here all the type of drugs that are normally drugs that would be druggies type use, or are they type of drugs that would also be controlled substances from any other area? In other words, people who are using them for veterinarian purposes, for using them for other purposes other than druggies, I guess.
Yes, there are. There are both here. There are those that are used just totally illegally, have no medical use at all, nor either for animal use or not. And then there are some here that are used by veterinarians and tranquilizers of animals, which has been a very popular drug on the street. Washington, D.C., for instance, is having a wave of animal tranquilizer drugs being used there. Nobody seems to know why, but it's very popular there. We haven't had that particular problem for probably 8 or 9 years. It's been a relative non-drug used in the Alaska area.
Well, how does that work? Does people just call up their local veterinarian and if he's into this type of thing, using them for human use, then they becomes like a dealer or something, and then you guys would bust them?
Certainly, that's one of the manners that it happens. There's also their offices are burglarized, their drugs are stolen, they then enter the legal drugs enter the illicit market. Very popular way to get the safer drugs, if you will, rather than buying them, you know, that are made in a laboratory in the backyard. Physicians' drugs are much more popular amongst those who use narcotics, heroin particularly. Much safer. You know what you're getting. You know that it's clean. You know the dose.
Excuse me, I have a series of questions here. Why does the most cannabis derivatives on the federal schedule are under a different schedule than we do? Why are we different than the feds on how we define cannabis in our schedule of illegal drugs?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure I can answer that. I know that when the drug bill, when the drug bill first went in 1982, the original draft matched the federal schedule, and then there were a series of hearings and various committee meetings regarding what the Alaska law should be, and certain criteria were adopted and are right now set out in the statute in terms of classification as to seriousness. And based on those criteria, that's how substances are classified in Alaska. And earlier on in the afternoon, we had a lady that was available that could testify, Gwen Pruitt.
She's online.
She maybe could answer that question better. I know that some of these substances are, even in this bill, placed pursuant to Alaska criteria rather than the federal, so they're not exactly in the same place even in this bill.
Well, I'm interested in having, where'd Senator Smith go? He's in the room. Okay. I'm interested in having the federal schedule match, or the Alaskan schedule match the federal schedule. So could your department work up a CS on the bill of what it would look like to have us totally in compliance with the federal schedule?
Madam Chair, I'm sure
Howard,
we could
ask on 158.
I'm sure we could ask the Department of Law to do that, and
okay.
I'll be glad to pass that request.
Okay, why don't we do that? That would be great. Have you folks seen the proposed CS before us right now with the change on Benzedrine on, or oh, am I saying that right? Let me see here. Benzedrex on page 5, the inhaler. How do you feel about that?
Madam Chair, I haven't seen the CS. I saw Ms. Otto's letter to the committee suggesting that change, and we agree with that proposed amendment.
Okay. Then what I'd like to do is have the Department of Law work up a draft that would put the Alaskan schedule of drugs in compliance with the federal schedule and let the committee look at that and then see which one they want to pass out.
I wonder if you wanted to ask Ms. Pruitt. Maybe she has.
Yes, Ms. Pruitt, do you have any idea why the state of Alaska's cannabis derivatives are under a different schedule than the federal?
with the Department of Law at the time that the bill was actually passed, so I don't have enough of a history on that. I can't answer your question.
Okay, well, if we can get, if Tuesday is enough time to get that, that'll be great. And otherwise, we'll just wait until the Department of Law can get that done for us before we move this bill.
What are cannabis
derivatives?
Yes, ma'am. Ms. Pruitt.
Are you speaking specifically of the THC and hashish? That section would also include your dronabinol and minabolone. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
I guess what I want, Ms. Pruitt, is a side-by-side of how the Alaskan schedule differs from the federal schedule, which drugs are different, and then an explanation as to why, and then a CS prepared that would put the state of Alaska in total compliance with the federal schedule along their same degree. And then I want the committee to decide how they want to handle it.
Okay, that's fine. May I make it explain quickly that the criteria for scheduling and the Alaska Act is a little different from the federal Act.
Yes, ma'am. Well, we would need to be totally consistent, and maybe we have to change the Alaska statutes all the way through. I mean, that would be maybe a next mission for the committee.
Uh-huh.
Okay. All right, Ms. Pruitt, I'll be talking to you. Committee staff, Mr. Christensen, we'll be working with you and the Department of Law and doing that. Ms. Horetsky and Lieutenant Stern, do you have any other testimony before the committee?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Does this meet with your okay that we get a little more information on this? Okay. Thank you. Gentlemen, how nice to have you both back.
Well, I never hardly left your eyesight.
Okay. What I would like is if we could go back, please, to Senate Bill 123. We have adopted the CS with the amendment. Mr. Christensen, am I correct that we had a quorum here when we adopted the CS for... Okay.
Yes, Madam Chair.
And we had a quorum when we adopted the amendment and a new CS. We need a motion to move out a new committee substitute for Judiciary 123.
Move and ask unanimous consent that we move CS.
Wait.
Senate Bill 123, Judiciary... amended?
Yes. What we did, Senators, we put a new section on page 1 down on lines 27 and 28 about eminent domain, and then we added a tax capture amendment as Mr. Bradley wrote it up in his legal
opinion. Was it the old agricultural tax recapture?
Well, it deals with conservation easement tax capture.
Okay.
And we passed this amendment.
CS?
No, we adopted a new CS with this amendment in it, and that's now what we'd like to move out.
You mean we have a conceptual CS?
No, it's right here, print? Senator. It's right here.
This is not
that was the amended.
Where does it appear in the bill?
It now has been amended into it.
Yes, it's going to be a new section under the numerical.
Okay, now I know. We're passing out a CS that really isn't exactly drafted perfectly. We're just accepting it. Okay, I have no objections.
Just say, it's moved.
A new CS incorporating the amendment the committee passed is adopted, passed out of committee with individual recommendations
for
Senate
Bill
123.
Is this for 7 years or 10 years? This was 7 years or 10 years.
The bill's
now,
gone now.
It's gone. It's too bad about the Eagle River Valley.
Senator Farenkamp, are you back for now? Oh, Tom, please. Senate Bill 98. We have a CS before us. It makes three changes to the bill. This is the bill providing a reduction in the scheduled bail or imposed a fine imposed against certain persons cited for committing a moving traffic infraction and providing for an effective date. Notice that the title was typed. And then on page 2, line 1, it changes the term appropriate safety device to read child safety devices as required under AS 2805-095. This was a recommendation of the committee. Senator Farenkamp's original bill was rather generic in that line, and we wanted to specifically state child support devices, child safety devices, as is currently in the statute, and then we added an immediate effective date to this bill. Comments, questions?
Yeah.
Tom's here.
You ready to move CS?
I have a research.
Let's just adopt it.
Can we adopt a CS for this bill?
I move and ask unanimous consent. We adopt a CS.
For Senate Bill 98.
Senate Bill 98.
Ready to move
great.
It.
Great. Please move the bill.
Like move it out with individual recommendations?
Hearing no objection, Senate Bill 98, Judiciary, is moved out with individual recommendations. Do you want to sign, sir?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your patience.
I only wish the Resources Committee moved as well.
Well, we've had these before. That's the problem. We have one left. Mr. Parker, are you here for 159?
I am, sir.
Why don't we take testimony? Senator Szymanski and I will listen to you, and knowing that we can't move it out because we've lost our quorum, we don't know where Senator Rohde is.
I have to be in.
Yeah, we understand. No problem. We did very well today. Pretty well.
Yeah, with the.
Senate Bill 159 is an act limiting liability relating to release and supervision of persons in state custody and providing for an effective date. I hope this isn't the Horton bill a la Cooper. Okay. At the present time, the state is liable for negligence in the release or supervision of persons from state custody, such as people released on parole, probation, work release, furlough, etc. The state isn't supposed to release people who are in danger, and they are supposed to supervise these people. Oh, this is the Horton bill. I was just making a joke. Mr. Parker, maybe I better be quiet and let you talk. Go ahead.
Thank you, Senator. Thanks for scheduling the bill. It is a governor's bill. I'm Bill Parker, Department of Corrections. The department is following it. Despite the fact we have a zero fiscal note here, when the state loses a tort case, the money is budgeted from the Division of Risk Management, and Brad Thompson, the deputy director, is here to talk about the cases that we have lost and other cases that are still pending. But generally, I wanted to make the point with you how important this is, because one of these judgments was for over $5 million in a single case. A probationer got drunk and murdered three people in a village, Point Lay, and the result was a $5 million payment from the state treasury to the families that survived. So the point is, despite the fact that the bill is short and sweet, it's a very big deal financially to the state. And because it doesn't come from our budget, we've got a zero fiscal note in, but there's a lot of money involved here, and that's why the bill's important.
Mr. Parker, here's my problem. I have a bill in that I can't get out of House Judiciary that limits the liability of municipal zoos, nonprofit zoos, to negligence. I mean, if the zoo is negligent, then they're liable. But there's an inherent risk at attending a zoo. And common law says that if the inherent risk should be taken into account in government zoos, but it doesn't say anything about nonprofit zoos. And of course, Alaska only has a nonprofit zoo, not a government or a municipal zoo. The House Judiciary Committee thinks I'm trying to maim and mangle little children. Then we had a bill in this committee that would eliminate a form of liability to athletic officials, that if they are athletic official, that they should be liable for making sure second base is posted, you know, stamped down. And we had a heck of a time getting that bill out of committee. It still hasn't gotten on the floor of the Senate, and I think it's going to have a terrible time reducing the liability for athletic officials on the floor of the Senate. And now the administration comes along and wants to limit the liability that the state would have for releasing or paroling or putting on probation people who have committed crimes. So I ask you, does this include folks that have committed violent crimes? Is there a restriction for violent crimes? Or how is this committee supposed to review this bill in relationship to the other two, what would be sort of benign bills that we've struggled with for this session, and I can't get out of House Judiciary on the other side? Do you have some advice, Mr. Parker?
You probably don't need my advice, Senator, on how to get a bill out of House Judiciary, but
yes, I do, Mr. Parker.
I can tell you generally that there are about 2,500 probationers and about 500 parolees out there right now, and there are 64 probation parole officers. So they're scattered. The probationers are scattered in every village and every corner of the state, and we don't have those 64 officers. Of course, are not in every corner of the state. They're mainly in the population centers, and they, through the mails and sometimes by voice visitations, try to call on these guys, but they're this is the shorthand version of it. They're not closely supervised. We are the deep pocket. When any of those guys drinks and commits another crime, since the Neacock decision, which had to prove simple negligence, any attorney now in the state would love to have one of those cases. You can hit a home run. In California, their state legislature has totally immunized the state against probationers or parolees. So, liability for zoos. We put this bill in last year too, and it got nowhere. It is not an interesting bill on the face of it, but there are millions of dollars involved, and the state, as I said, is a deep pocket.
I guess what I'm worried about, though, is the health and safety of our constituents, the people of Alaska, and I know you are too. I'm not trying to make a political deal here. I'm worried about it. And I'm worried about letting people, I voted no on the good time bill. Okay, that's where I'm coming from. So, you know, I'm just worried about not having a state entity worry about these folks when they're out there. I think we let them out maybe too early, or we let them out to relieve overcrowdedness. Or I'm just concerned that the state not have a liability and an obligation to watch over these folks.
We still have that obligation, that liability. The question is, when things go wrong, there is a risk, of course, to putting, it's like there's a risk going to the zoo, there's a risk of putting an offender back in the street. When things go wrong, if it's simple negligence, we're going to pay big time every time. The passage of this bill, frankly, won't change the level of supervision that we give probationers or parolees, because we only have so many officers, and they do the best they can, but a state this size are not going to. Because the state is liable. See, the department's budget's not involved. This doesn't come out of corrections when we lose. So, in a way, I guess I could say, gee, we're doing the best we can, it's none of our business. But I'm just telling you that since this Neacock decision, the attorneys are lining up to look for these cases. We just had another murder in Togiak by a probationer. And those families' phones are ringing off the hook because there's big money involved.
Okay. Mr. Parker, Brad Thompson from Division of Risk Management is wanting to testify. Please stay at the table with us. I know Senator Schmancy is going to have comments. I want to, at this time, I was being flip about the Horton case when we started this because I hadn't done my homework and I hadn't read Mr. Christensen's thing. So I apologize for you for being flip. I do not want to make a political statement out of this thing, so please accept my apologies. And for the record, I didn't mean to do it. I had no idea what we were dealing with here. I just didn't do my homework. Mr. Thompson, you hush. Mr. Thompson.
Yeah, my name's Brad Thompson. I'm Deputy Director of the Division of Risk Management. Our charge basically is handling the insurance claims. This is one type of claim that is filed against the state. The limitation of liability that we're requesting in this bill will basically establish a clear threshold in which the state can be held responsible. The prior case that everyone talks about is the Neacock case. There was a Supreme Court opinion that came down about 2 years ago that gave clear insight that the state does have a duty for the actions and controlling and supervising the actions of a parolee, and that duty, if it's either through an action or inaction of a state employee, a claim arises, they have no immunity for that. It's interesting to note that Supreme Court opinion actually was a 3-2 decision. The two dissenting judges made a very clear statement that they felt that the state should not be subject to such liability, and that further, that the acts of the probation and the parole officer should be discretionary, parallel to what would happen from a judge on the bench as to what sentencing should happen with this individual. The Neacock case arose from a mandatory release prisoner who was about 9 months after his release back to a village of between 30 and 60 people, back to his original village, went and after, I think he had some family disputes, got intoxicated, got a weapon, and did the mayhem with the three families. The foreseeability of that was held against the Department of Corrections in the court opinion. practically, as Mr. Parker has already stated, the parole officers are unable, through the caseloads and through the geographical locations of these prisoners, to find and control and monitor them to the level that this Supreme Court case has now established is the duty owed. And
Mr. Thompson, are you based here in Juneau?
Yes.
Okay, and I know Mr. Parker is. What I'd like to do, sir, Senator Schmanke has some specific questions today, fine. This bill is so important that I'd like to bring it up on Tuesday in front of the full committee. I mean, I'm being optimistic about the full committee being here, but I'd like the full committee to hear this. And what I'd like is for you to then, or Mr. Christensen, is to have the case, the Supreme Court case, delineated for us. Mm-hmm. We'll go over it. Mr. Christensen, let's go over the case, what's required, and then have the Department of Corrections tell us what those parole officers are doing and not doing. And then let's look at the whole issue and then see if this is the only way out. And you must have thought of this, I know, in the administration before you put something like this in. Senator Szymanski, do you have any comments today or questions today that you'd like them to work on prior to this week?
A couple of questions related to their testimony. I'm not familiar with the Neocon case, and I appreciate the overview, brief overview you've given. You indicated it came down about 2 years ago?
The opinion from the Supreme Court. The case initially started in 1980, the actions.
This
is just one of five cases that we have had to pay an average of over $1 million per case.
I think we need that, too. Let's get the list of the cases, what the settlement was, what the conditions were. And I think, Mr. Parker, this is one of those issues that the House Judiciary and the Senate Judiciary Committee agreed to work together on those issues that we thought we could do without politics, okay? This might be one of those issues. So what we might want to do is set up a meeting between the principals of the committees, with the governor's office, with yourself, and see if we want to handle this in a united, non-political fashion and look over the facts and see if we can't reach some sort of solution to your problem. You have a problem, I understand, but the public also, the safety of the public has a problem, and we have a problem if the parole officers aren't plentiful enough and aren't being funded correctly. I mean, maybe we can strike some sort of balance here rather than just automatically doing this. I don't think this passes House Judiciary right now. Do you?
I'm worried about the Senate Judiciary. So.
Well, you got problems in here too, I think.
Well, I just want to try to before we walk it through, we're going to get out of here in a second. The statement you made was that in the Neocon case, they apparently were able to make a determination that either supervisory action or lack of action was your testimony, and that the individual was underneath a mandatory release, but the court found that the mandatory release should have been able to be not been released? How can you have a mandatory release if the court can find that you can't?
It was more the duty of what the state owed after he is released. They could not have not released the prisoner.
We do concur. It was mandatory release.
Yes.
And that the court found that after he was released underneath the mandatory program, that the state could have had the power, the ability to make a judgment call which would have restrained him or refrained him from committing the act?
Yes, it was more the question of whether the state owed a duty to the potential victims of this parolee.
No determination.
The foreseeability of him again committing a criminal act.
But your statement, let me see if I can understand this correctly. Your statement was that then the state has the victims, owes the victims some compensation or something for the act committed, but what I'm having a little problem following is where was the negligence on the state's part from the court's perspective?
It was twofold. One, in the release, the method of release, although it was mandatory, there should have been more conditions made on the individual not to have alcohol, although there was a condition not for him to touch weapons, etc. There was basically a later determination that the conditions of parole could have been tougher, and then once paroled, then he should have been better monitored or more carefully monitored. The difficulty being is the assigned parole officer had only seen this person twice, once while in jail and once by happenstance in another village.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to getting into this because, you know, in every case where I'm running into this, where we're looking for exemptions, mm-hmm. we continually find that the court may not have been far off as everybody likes to lead you to believe. And that is, let me tell you, a guy that's in there and related to alcohol who's released and parole officer says you can continue to drink, seems pretty gross negligence to me, or negligent on somebody's part. It seems like
it was omitted. It wasn't that it was a condoned activity. It was not within the restriction in the agreement.
Well, you know what they say out here about speed limits? You do whatever it says you can't do.
Well, they're better in Juneau than they are in Anchorage. I have to slow down.
See what I'm saying there on that? Yeah. Right? That's what the court said, too.
Well, okay.
You can do whatever, you're not restricted. And that's why, and they said, because you guys didn't do such a great job of carrying out your duty, you owe the victims some compensation.
Yeah, there's more to it than
okay, but we'll get into that. It's hard for me to restrict.
Person. Yeah. This is not Department of Corrections. This is the insurance person here trying to tell. What we need is a Department of Corrections here, too. Mr. Parker, I thought of another one, too. We got in a huge fight on the Senate floor. Was the municipality bill Busby. That wants to limit Busby. The Busby case. Oh, my goodness. That almost didn't pass the Senate. So I think what we need is to spell out the issues like you did. Let's go over the case. And Mr. Christian said, if you'll do that for us, go over the case, the stipulations in the case. And then let's look at what the Department of Corrections has to work with. And then Senator Szymanski, I've set up, Mr. Parker's going to set up a meeting with the House informally, and let's get Mr. Szymanski in on that meeting as vice chair of this committee. Okay?
He's good at setting up those joint meetings.
Okay, this is one of those issues we're going to have to do it.
So did I, by agreeing to that, did I talk myself out of our Tuesday hearing then?
No, sir. I want the committee to be aware of this, but I don't want it to be energized before we have some feeling as to what's going to happen with the House.
I understand. Why don't I'll stop by there on the way down right now and see if we can get any interest in this.
Okay.
If we don't, then I'll
come back and go for a Tuesday meeting with us.
Okay, you bet. Absolutely. And we appreciate you folks staying. And did you have to stay the whole time, or did you hear my name? You came back?
Came back.
Good.
I want you there. A little soup bill would help out, too, bring you back.
Yeah, meeting adjourned. Thank you very much.